Welcome everyone to episode 19 of the Greater European Talks. Today we're focusing on the theme of Central and Southeast Europe, and today we have three other speakers joining. First, we have Adrian Waters joining from Rome. He'll be speaking a little bit about the previous Macedonian elections. Want to say hello?
Hello.
Next, we will have a new speaker here, Eva, who is joining me here in Bruges, actually. We're sitting next to each other recording, and she'll be talking a little bit about the Montenegrin elections.
Hello.
Thirdly, we have Roxandra, who has been on the podcast before, joining us from Suceava in Romania, and she will be talking about the upcoming Romanian local elections.
Hello, everyone.
And last, by no means least, we have myself, as usual, Philippe joining, also from Bruges, and I'll be talking a little bit about the Swiss referendums. So this week will be a very kind of voting election heavy discussion, and it's going to be interesting to see how these elections have shaped some of the countries themselves and the wider impact and fallout these will or may have to the countries of Greater Europe. So beginning us off, Adrian, tell us what happened in the North Macedonian elections. Who profited from them, and what does this mean?
Well, these elections have been probably the most controversial and also the most important elections since 2016, which happened in the aftermath of the colourful revolution. As some of you may know, if you've read my articles, which I've published on the Institute for Greater Europe website, which are The Truth About the Prespa Agreement and Of Bombs and Hybrid Regimes, How the Macedonian Colourful Revolution Went Full Circle, you would know that Macedonia gained this new prime minister in Zoran Zaev, who is leader of SDSM, or the Social Democratic Union of Macedonia. In 2018, he signed this agreement with Greece to solve the name dispute between the two countries, although the deal failed to get enough popular support in a referendum. Zaev proceeded to implement this deal by using a combination of Balkan and rational approaches, as suggested by the EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn at the time. This involved mainly bribing, blackmailing, or intimidating 8 members of the opposition to vote for the name deal, which was finally adopted in early 2019. And then he consolidated his power with a victory in the presidential elections by his candidate Stevo Pendarovski, although these elections were marred by irregularities and the lowest turnout in the history of Macedonian presidential elections. Now, these elections happened in the aftermath of France vetoing Macedonia's entry into the European Union, or, well, the start of accession negotiations in October 2019. And so Zaev resigned in January this year, and then he was replaced by a technical administration that was supposed to rule the country only for 3 months until elections were held. This has been the practice since 2015, when the Prgino Agreement was signed. It was an EU and US brokered agreement which said that before any parliamentary election, there will be 100 days where there's a technical administration that would have ministers from both the governing and the opposition parties. And that was the situation in Macedonia up until the 15th of July elections. The elections were supposed to be held in April, but then they were postponed to July because of the coronavirus crisis. Now, in this election, the turnout was 52%, and the results are as follows, but I'm warning you that these results should be taken with a pinch of salt, because the State Electoral Commission website crashed on election night because it was hacked. Nobody knows who did it. So just take these with a pinch of salt. So the results were 46 seats for the SDSM coalition, which also includes BESA. If you exclude them, then SDSM only has 42 seats. Then you have Vomero Deponeme, the opposition center-right party. It has 44 seats. Then you have DUE, the Democratic Union for Integration, which is the largest party that represents the Albanian ethnic minority. It has 15 seats. And then you have two other Albanian parties, the Alliance for the Albanians and Alternativa, getting 12 seats. And then you have a smaller Albanian party, the DEPA, Democratic Party of the Albanians, getting only one seat. But the most interesting thing about this election is that for the first time, Levica, which is a minor left-wing party, gained 2 seats, although it has claimed that it was actually robbed of 3 seats in these elections. As a matter of fact, all the opposition parties, which include Vamora Deponomene and Alliance for the Albanians, have complained to the State Electoral Commission, claiming that there were numerous irregularities, such as ballot stuffing, vote buying in Roma neighborhoods, and groups of men promoting their political party. The General Secretary of the Sedesuma also violated electoral silence by urging voters on Twitter to come out and vote. As they're saying, there was a low turnout, there was of 52%, in contrast to 2016 when it was 66.8%. There are numerous factors that explain this. So obviously there's apathy, there's also the coronavirus crisis, and also many years of non-stop political crises. The results showed that there was a no clear majority, as it was the case back in 2016. Eventually, Zaev was given a mandate to form a government together with the Democratic Union for Integration, even though at the time he didn't even have the numbers or even an agreement with Dui. In the end, he did gain a coalition, but it's a razor-thin coalition. The Macedonian parliament has 120 seats, so if you want to make a government, you need at least 61. And he has a majority of 62, which will comprise his party, Dui, Besa, and the Democratic Party of the Albanians. So the history of Macedonia shows that if there are any serious disputes within a ruling coalition, then it is likely to fall, and this means that new elections will have to be held. And the consensus among the opposition parties say is that this government is not going to last that long, probably until the next local elections in 2021.
I see. So, I mean, Adrian, it seems like the government is definitely on a very thin edge, but they have managed to just gain control. Is this therefore seen as, you know, quite a major victory from the ruling government, or are they still disappointed and they're looking for and they won't be able to push as much as they want to? They were hanging on a little bit, really, in these elections. Does this kind of show in the turnout and the end result?
Well, indeed, before they actually gained this new government, there were some members of Dui who even threatened to vote against the deal. So if there are any sort of disruptions in parliament, it's likely that this government will not be able to achieve much.
Okay, interesting. And I mean, does this mean that the agreement, name change agreement, is now secure? Because this was probably one of the major risks of the end of the agreement, was potentially the ousting of a government who signed the agreement. Does this mean security for this new deal and the security of the name North Macedonia?
At the moment, yes. But obviously, this government doesn't have enough legitimacy or even popular support. In fact, recently, there have been loads of demonstrations in the street, some led by the opposition Vamora Deponomene, some led by grassroots organizations. And these are mainly protests against the sort of hike in electricity prices. So electricity bills have gone up by 7.5%. And the problem is that the regulatory commission chief, he has links to the governing citizen, because he was once spotted at the headquarters of the party. So this contradicts the claims that this body is neutral. In reality, it is partisan.
Hey, interesting. Ruthandra, Eva, is there any sort of questions or concerns you had in regard to the elections?
Well, are there any international responses to the electoral controversy? Because you mentioned that the official website crashed at some point and it was hacked. Are there any responses from the OSCE or international bodies monitoring it?
The OSCE, yeah, they did monitor the elections and noted that there were some problems, but nothing much has happened to kind of see what was behind this hacking. In the end, the State Electoral Commission decided to make official these results, which I just mentioned, which when they came out, they were considered the preliminary or unofficial result. But as I said, all the opposition parties have asked the State Electoral Commission for a manual recount, but this proposal was rejected.
Oh, I see.
That's interesting.
Okay. I mean, is there anything else you can really tell us about the sort of the future of it now? Because now the government has finally been agreed after quite a long time. What's on their main agenda now?
Well, obviously, they'll try and start to sort of accession talks with the EU. I mean, they were received the green light earlier this year, but as you know, it is pretty unlikely that they'll get it anytime soon. Even the president of the Republic, Stevo Pendarovski, mm-hmm. admitted that he was reluctant to have new member states because of enlargement fatigue and other factors. And also they're trying to improve their anti-corruption image by setting up an anti-corruption commission, but a lot of experts have doubts about this new commission, especially because, as it has been revealed in the past year and a half or so, Zaev himself is involved in many corruption schemes, in the numerous extortion scandals, and even his own family, which is pretty much a mafia family, which has control of the businesses in their home town of Strumica, where Zaev used to be the mayor for 11 years. There have been cases where some opponents of his have been beaten up, or some opposition activists have had their cars torched, and there are numerous underground elements linked to Sedesima, which operates a security agency in Strumica, which was involved in extortion from various business owners in the city. And now this group has expanded to other cities throughout the country, now that the Zaev is in charge.
Wow, those are quite strong statements. I want to add those are Adrian's statements, not the Institute's, but nevertheless, very interesting statements.
Can only add that it's sort of a pattern in this region, because when we're going to talk about Montenegro, there are some similar stories when it comes to corruption and crime and people in power. Mm. So it seems to be a pattern.
Would you call this election, Adrian, an improvement on the previous election? Like, how would you compare it to previous electoral situations, previous elections of the same type? You mentioned that obviously the number dropped, you know, from 66%, I think you mentioned, now 52%. Were there other aspects of it that made you think that this was definitely like one of a poor election as a whole? Or do you think it's just a sort of a string of similar unsatisfactory elections?
Well, this is... what we had this year was the lowest turnout since 2006, when it was 56%. And in the following years, the turnout kind of gradually increased up until 2016, when it was 66%. Obviously, COVID-19 didn't help. And also, there, as I said, there was also many years of non-stop crises since 2014. We've had the colorful revolution, then Zaev taking over, the name deal, the referendum, the aftermath, the presidential elections last year, and then this ongoing corruption scandal, which involved also the special prosecutor's office, which was a body established in 2015 as part of the Prizhino agreement, which I mentioned earlier.
Okay, thank you. Are there any sort of final comments you want to add to this topic? Maybe a crystal ball gazing for the future? Do you believe in that sense that, the local elections might be the end of this sort of very narrow, razor-thin government?
Well, as in every prediction made by political scientists, is like predicting the weather, I think. You could end up saying something that is truthful and something that turns out to be false.
I think that's a very diplomatic diplomatic statement there, although I must agree, yes, that is, I find crystal ball gazing is just that, gazing, no true elements derived from it.
But I still hold the position that this government is not going to last that long, most probably until next year.
Okay.
Because, as I said, the majority is razor thin, and any disagreement would lead to a collapse of the government.
Well, we look forward to inviting you back in a year's time to see if you're right on that correction. And if so, then at least we could say you heard it here first, folks. So thank you. Moving not too far away, indeed just an Albanian span away, to Montenegro, we have the Montenegrin elections, which were also, they were perhaps a bit more revelatory there. Eva, tell us what happened.
Yes. So the elections took place exactly 2 weeks ago, on 31st of August, and I could only repeat some of the things Adrian already mentioned, the razor-thin majority. We have the same case here. So the opposition won the election by an extremely thin majority, and the pro-Western party, DPS, the Democratic Party of Socialists, with Milo Djukanovic, who has led Montenegro for 3 decades, won most of the vote, but fell one single seat short of majority. So in the end, we have a parliament with 81 seats, the opposition won 41, and 40 went to the former
president of the parliament. So Milo Djukanovic won the vote, but lost in the end. When we are talking about the opposition, we could say that it's a very colorful bunch. So we have parties who now form one single group, but they couldn't be more different. We have a party, Democratic Front, who is the largest opposition party, right-wing party. And this is a party with very close ties to Serbia and to Moscow. And then we have other parties who do not share this policy, but they still form the opposition group. We have the Peace is Our Nation Party and the United Reformed Action Party. And they are really, it's an interesting group because we have a party that actually contests the sheer existence of Montenegrin nationality and statehood. And we have a party like United Reformed Action Party, who wants a technocratic government, who is more, so to say, future-oriented. And when we're talking about the DPS, yes, as I said, it's a pro-Western party. It is a party who led Montenegro to NATO. We know that Montenegro joined in 2017. And this is also the party which started the negotiations with the European Union in 2012. However, they lost now because also, I can repeat what Adrian said, they were really involved in many different scandals, corruption scandals. Milo Djukanovic, who is still the president, but he lost on the parliamentary elections, he was also involved in what they say was organized crime. So he does have, so to say, a history, but one cannot deny that he did play a major role in country's politics, and he has been, as I said, in power for 3 decades, so since 1990. Well, maybe for me, what was the most interesting thing about this elections was the main topic of the election campaign. One would maybe assume that it would be the economic crisis because Montenegro was hit very hard by the pandemic. However, the economic issues were not the main topic. What was on the agenda were religious issues. Mm-hmm. Montenegro is a country which is very divided. If there was one key word to use for this election and for the country, for the society as a whole, that's polarization. We have on the one side the Serbian Orthodox Church and the Montenegrin Orthodox Church. The Montenegrin Orthodox Church was founded recently, we could say, in 1993, and the Serbian Orthodox Church has the majority in the country, so I think around 70% of Orthodox religious people in Montenegro are part of the Serbian Orthodox Church, and only 30% are part of the Montenegrin Orthodox Church. So what was the problem? Why was this so high on the agenda? Well, last year, the government of Milo Djukanovic passed a law, a very controversial law, about religious assets. So according to this law, the state has the right to just take the assets, so to claim them, if the church cannot prove historic ownership. So they have the right to claim it. And of course, there were protests. The Serbian Orthodox Church claimed that this law is very discriminatory and that it's aimed at the Serbian Orthodox Church. But one could say maybe that with this law, with the protest that followed, that Milo Djukanovic kind of laid his own bed. Because you in Montenegro, if you pick a fight with the Serbian Orthodox Church, and in Montenegro, we might say there is still no clear division between church and state, it's a lost game. So this was the main issue. This was what divided the voters in the end, because even the Orthodox priests were inviting the people to vote for the opposition and not for the DPS because of this said law.
I see. And so what's the main impact of the opposition now winning this? Have they managed to form a government now? Are they now in ownership of the government?
They are in negotiations, and what we could expect is a technocratic government, because the United Reformed Action Party is kind of, it's a it's a party that won only a few votes. However, they are the one who will be decisive for forming this government, and their leader is asking for a technocratic government. So we could expect that. The question is only how long they will last as a government, because this is, as I said, an opposition with many different interests. They are not really a homogenous group of parties. They are very, very different, and they have different aspirations. So it remains to be seen how this is going to play out, really.
Thank you. Adrian or Ruxandra, do you want to get in on this? Any comments or questions?
Well, two things. Firstly, in my view, what happened with the law on the Serbian Orthodox Church was probably the last straw for many people. And as the ongoing protests have been a way of demonstrating anger, not just about this law, but also anger towards Milo Djukanovic and his quasi-authoritarian rule. And second thing, there's this great tweet that came out after the election. I'm just going to show you here, but it's a picture of Milo Djukanovic, and next to him is Vucic of Serbia, Edi Rama of Albania, and Zoran Zaev of Macedonia. And there is a cross over Milo Djukanovic's head.
Oh, wow. I see. That's a very evocative picture there.
Yeah, but so I get the, one get hybrid the idea. Regime leader down, three more to go.
Interesting.
I would also add to the list of Boyko Borisov of Bulgaria and Viktor Orban of Hungary.
Interesting. To any who are particularly favourable to them, please do remember this is not the Institute's point of view, but it is a person's point of view. Yes. I mean, we keep going. I mean, where do we stop, really? Boris Johnson, I'm happy to add him. But no, he's not as much of an autocrat.
But how about Lukashenko right now? Does he have a cross?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's
on top of his head or not?
Yes, that's a very good point. Expect to keep seeing more tweets, I think, with an extended list of people, Adrian. That's one thing to be sure of. Is there any question you necessarily wanted to pose, or Eva, you wanted to come in there, I think?
Well, maybe just now talking a bit about what might happen in the future. What is argued is that a huge change in foreign policy of Montenegro could be expected because of it. Because as we know, as I said, those are the parties close to Russia and to Serbia. Mm. So it is expected that maybe a change in foreign policy will be seen in the future. And two very important points, I think. The first one is the question of Kosovo, because Montenegro, as we know, recognized Kosovo during the reign of Milo Djukanovic. However, now there is the question of what will happen, and could Montenegro potentially withdraw the recognition of Kosovo? Because we have a new party in power, so a new group of opposition parties who are closer to Putin and to Vucic. And the second point, I think, what will happen to NATO and to membership in NATO? Because as we know, the country was so far Western-oriented, and the question is, what will happen now? Will, in the foreseeable future, if the government lasts, could it happen that the country maybe leaves NATO because of his close relationship with Serbia? I personally don't think so, but it is something that is that's been debated since the election because of the change in power and a new government.
My question there, I think, wouldn't revolve about NATO necessarily. NATO's dealt with a lot worse, I think, autocratic regimes in member states. Also, there is no actual way to leave NATO in the current guides. However, Montenegro is the country who is furthest along in accession talks with the EU.
Yes.
In fact, they've closed some chapters already. Yes. And I think every chapter apart from a few are in stage three. So what is this? What effect do you think it has to do with EU accession? Because that's probably going to be a big one.
Well, what I've read recently is that there are no plans right now to change anything concerning the negotiations with the European Union. And I think the reason for that is, as I said, it's a colorful bunch of parties. And if they want to really remain in power, to be a technocratic government, to not lose the majority, because it is a thin majority, a very thin majority, that's right, they can't really, they are not going to discuss issues which are very divisive, you know, because we have different parties. Some are against the European Union, some are pro-European Union. So I don't think this will be on the agenda right now, because they are very, very fragile as a coalition.
Understood, understood. Ruxandra, did you want to come in there?
Maybe I was thinking about withdrawing their Kosovo recognition. Will that affect our relationship with the EU and NATO as well? Because there's kind of like a bit of a trend to recognize Kosovo. And there were like also talks, I know in terms of Bulgaria, there were also talks that this was part of their EU conditionality, not officially, but there were...
I don't think this will happen. I think this is just speculations, but I wanted to mention them because I think it's very interesting, you know, that after the election, this is what's talked about in the media. But I don't think that for now they're going to change anything drastically in their politics concerning Kosovo and the European Union, but who knows?
Yes.
Adrian,
I wanted to say, first of all, that there is actually also a growing number of countries which are de-recognizing Kosovo, like Suriname, for example.
Yeah.
And what you were saying earlier about withdrawing from NATO, well, I read this article which said that according to the terms of the North Atlantic Treaty, Montenegro cannot withdraw from NATO before 2037. In the Article 37 of the treaty, it says, after the treaty has been enforced for 20 years, any party may cease to be a party 1 year after its notice of denunciation has been given to the government of the United States of America, which will inform the governments of the other parties. So after a year's waiting period, the country that wants to leave would then be out. But even so, I think what Montenegro could do is what I call the goal method. Basically, downgrading the membership and withdrawing from US-led military command.
Yeah, and that would be quite a big deal because Montenegro only recently joined them. And I remember their recent actions. They joined recent training in Norway, and that was their first major operations. And I believe actually the Montenegrin army increased by a third just to kind of keep up with it. So it would be quite a shock to their current system. When are the presidential elections coming up, if you know?
I think that Milo Djukanovic will remain president for 2 more years.
Oh, I see.
So this will be very interesting to see how this parliament is going to work with such a thin majority and 40 seats still in the hands of DPS and the president.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Thank you. Any final comments you want to make?
Well, only that could be interesting that the only announcement of this new technocratic government is that they will, of course, change the law. So this law concerning restrictions when it comes to the proof of property ownership, because they are, of course, close to the Serbian Orthodox Church. So this is interesting, and this is very high on the agenda.
The first thing they said.
Well, I think they put it on fourth place. But still, I think that, it still shows that it's very important for them to change the law and to show that they have close ties with the Serbian Orthodox Church.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And moving, again, not too far, only one Serbian span away to the Romania, where we started talking a little bit about the local elections. So tell us, what are they? When are they, and why do they matter?
Well, what can I say? 2020 is definitely the year of COVID-19 and elections in our region. So I'm covering the Romanian elections, local elections, which are scheduled to be at the end of this year on the 27th of September. These elections were actually supposed to be held in June, but due to COVID constraints, they were postponed. The vote is done by a first-past-the-post system, as in the candidate who receives the most votes basically wins, and it will cover the all commune, town, and city councils, the 41 county councils, and the Bucharest Municipal General Council, and it will also count all the mayors of the communes, cities, and municipalities of the sectors of Bucharest. Bucharest has 6 sectors in total, and the general mayor of the municipality of Bucharest. So they're very important. The candidates are the following. So from the left, we have the Social Democrats, the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats, which is ALDE group, and Pro-Romania, which currently form the opposition in the current government. From the center and center right, there is the National Liberal Party, which has the current government. And the Save Romania Union and Plus Alliance, and the People's Movement Party, also known as PMP, which is the party of the former president of Romania, Traian Băsescu. There also is a Democratic Alliance of Hungarians in Romania, or abbreviated as UDMR, which is a political party that claims to be representative for the Hungarian minority of Romania. It presents itself as center and center right. However, in the last couple of years, it has been kind of like compromising its ideological values, and it was always like supporting the left and the social democrats. They usually get their votes in the three predominantly Hungarian-speaking counties, Mureș, Harghita, and Covasna. So they're also expected to win there this year, at least in Harghita and Covasna. In the latest polls run by Kurz, it is shown that the National Liberals are leading by 7%. So they expected to cast 33% of the votes, followed by the Social Democrats with 26%, USR Plus Alliance with 16%, Pro-Romania with 7%, PMP with 5%, and the others with 4% each. So I have a couple of observations. The first observation is that what we can see from this poll and other polls ran earlier this year is that the Social Democrats continue to lose ground. They were usually the strongest party or the party leading the votes in general. However, after they had the scandal with their former president, Liviu Dragnea, which was imprisoned for embezzlement, they kind of like try to find a good leader. So they still have internal factions that fight for power, and they kind of like ended up discrediting one another and thus discrediting the party itself. Just to mention, at the last parliamentary elections, they got 45% of the votes. So, and this year are expected to get around 30%. Also, what is new is that this election campaign will go on without public assemblies, without electoral rallies, and because they have to be in compliance with protection measures against COVID. And I think that this will help maintain the elections clean, as rallies were a well known place for bribery, either with money or non-perishable food or objects such as oil, flour, hats, pencils, buckets.
Pencils. Who gets bought with pencils?
Yes, well, you have the party logo on them and the colors.
Are they very
the
nice pencils?
It's a nice reminder that you should vote for them in the election day. So no rallies also mean that it will be difficult for local barons to assess the popularity of their political factions. However, there is a risk of blackmail and political clientelism, because in Romania, a 2001 anti-poverty policy provides mayors with tools for the coercive mobilization of voters during election. So it gives mayors full control over the distribution of anti-poverty benefits within locality. So basically, when elections come up, mayors exploit this vulnerability, and they just go like, we're going to cut the social benefits that you receive. So like, people need to go and vote for them, so that income should continue to come in their pockets. Another interesting thing to mention is that compared to previous elections, the youth sector is represented quite strongly in the local elections, where a lot of young people between 25 and 35 years old are official candidates on the list. I've never seen so many before, honestly. I think this is a really, really good thing. Some of them were strong voices in the civil society during the anti-corruption protests, or they come up from abroad where they worked for corporations, or have an educational background abroad. Also, some of the, I do know a couple of people that do have experience within EU institutions, such as doing a Blue Book traineeship or being a trainee at the European Parliament. So they will definitely bring a different mindset. Also, a lot of local entrepreneurs are on the list, and this will definitely add some value to their teams as it shows a move away from that kind of like nepotism, and because they most of them are not politically affiliated or they were never a member of any of those parties. And that's good because it will challenge. Ask me if you have something.
Sure, one question. I mean, how much power do local officials have in Romania? Do you think this is going, like, let's say it goes terribly wrong for the current government, will it make a big impact? Do people often protest vote against the current government if they don't like it? Or are they not as strong in Romania as other countries?
They're quite strong. I mean, there are very strategic counties that parties fight for. For example, Cluj, Cluj-Napoca, Timiș, and Timișoara, they're like rich places. And they're industrialized places. So parties usually fight to have those strategic places. And you have local barons, you know, like local, let's just say, county heads that control everything. And this is the thing that during these elections, they expect to be challenged. They are not. You don't have the same people on this list, and you have people, young people that can't be corrupted or have, as I mentioned before, no party or political affiliation. So they are expected to speak, to talk, you know, to be loudmouths basically, and to challenge the status quo or like the local formed groups. And they're actually they're quite active on Facebook, and when they see things, they report it online, and this is kind of like expected to add more transparency in the future. I mean, there are definitely strategic cities where the fight will be very tough, and the capital, it will be like a true war for the capital. And it's also, if you think about it, the councils and their capacity for tourism and creating revenue and everything that will provide the funds that they get from Bucharest, from the state. So it will be easier to access more funds from different localities. I mean, the vote will be cast in person, and Romanians can only vote in the village or town with their residences. This will be different at the parliamentary elections, which are supposed to be held by the end of this year. It hasn't been decided yet. And diaspora will be able to vote through correspondence. And usually they vote for center and center right parties.
Adrian or Eva, do you want to add anything, any questions or comments?
Well, I do have one question. You mentioned this large number of young people on the lists. Why now? What happened? Is it something about these elections in particular, or was it also a trend that you could notice before in previous elections, that there many young people are really interested in politics and want to change something?
I think there are two reasons for it. First of all, my country was kind of like affected by COVID. It was quite a panic at some point, and a lot of people wanted to get involved and they wanted to volunteer to help. Also, the civil society became stronger year by year because we had so many anti-corruption protests that actually worked in the end. And I would say that young people kind of like gained this courage to speak about these issues, but they also went abroad and got some training or, I don't know, started a firm at home and learned exactly what the problems are in their localities. How can you deal with a bureaucratic, such a horrible bureaucratic system that we have? And at the same time, there are a lot of newly formed parties. I think that, like, Save Romania Union and the Plus Alliance, in the last European elections, they casted 16% of the votes. And it was the first time they participated. And if you look at the teams, it's just like freshly graduated students or like former technocrats or corporate or former corporate people, but usually very young.
A positive step, at least.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anything you want to add, Adrian? Or Ruxandra, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the future, essentially. That was one thing you mentioned.
It will, I think, midterm, it will definitely, I definitely expect to see a lot more transparency in the local processes. And I do expect that there will be a lot more, or a better process of digitalization in the mayor halls, at least, as in we still can't submit forms online and we still have to do everything in person. I also expect to see a lot more projects in order to access European funds. I think our absorption rate is somewhere between like under 5% of what we're allowed to apply for. They're very, very low because of the whole bureaucracy behind it.
Mm-hmm. That is an issue. That is an issue. Anything you want to add, Adrian? Shall we?
You were talking earlier about sort of rival factions within parties. Well, even within the Zaev Sedasamer, there are two rival factions. There is the rural ring, to which he belongs to, and there is the urban wing, which is based in the capital, Skopje. And there are some news sites in Macedonia saying that he's trying to consolidate his position within the party by changing the statute so that all party members will be able to vote for who is in charge, i.e. their leader. And in this way, some people think that if he has the mandate of the membership and he increases the number of loyalists in the government, he'll be stronger against his rival urban wing. These two factions are also expected to clash next year over the municipal elections, where they all have different favourites for several key municipalities. One of them is the position of the mayor of Skopje. Nowadays, it's held by a guy who belongs to the urban wing of the party, a guy called Petre Shilegov, but there are some reports that Zaev wants somebody else to be the mayor of Skopje next year. So that will be something to look out for.
Okay. Also, if you're talking about the mayor of a capital, we're kind of like expected to have an independent candidate as a mayor of Bucharest. He's supported by the center-right and right-wing parties. And that will be interested. He was educated in Paris and has a background in mathematics. So that will be very interesting.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Another election there to look forward to. Hopefully once they're over, we can also have another call about it. We can debate and see whether we got it right. Any final comments you want to make, or shall we move on?
The last comment I would like to make is that people do not vote for an ideological, for their, like, they do not vote for a party, or they do not vote in consideration with their ideological values. Now they only vote for someone that actually gets work done. That will be the main criteria. Someone that, you know, has a good professional experience, doesn't matter where, and is not known to be corrupted or compromised in any way. So you will see traditional right-wing areas voting for someone from a left-wing party or social democrat party just because they know he will get the job done. Hey. That's quite interesting.
That's actually rather positive, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's very, I guess, a hopeful way to end that particular topic. Yeah. Thank you. And so I'll be presenting the last country who is not in the Balkans, sadly, but in Central Europe, very central. We have Switzerland. So the Swiss, of course, love their referendums. They're one of the largest fans of it in the world. And sadly, they haven't been able to do referendums recently. In fact, many of them have been cancelled for the first time since 1951, which was only cancelled due to a massive foot and mouth disease epidemic, essentially. So I guess cancellations because of viruses have been a running theme. This means that in September, they will be voting on 5 referendums, which is not actually the highest they've voted for at the same time. They once voted for 8 in the mid-2000s. And I'll go them I'll go through them briefly in order from least to most important, because there's one particular one that I was talking about, which is about the EU, but the rest are still quite interesting. Hunting is the first one. The Swiss are looking to redo their Hunting Act. Combat aircraft, they're looking to repurchase. The Swiss got badly stung by a botched combat deal in the mid-2000s, and they're looking now for a valid contractor. The previous contract was actually defeated in 2014 by 53.4% of the voters. So this year, apparently the government have done their numbers better, and there's a strong belief that this one will not get voted down, but it's interesting to see that it's in response to that. The other two are interesting parental referenda, one on increasing paternity leave in Switzerland, because right now it is not equal between maternity leave and paternity leave. And the other one for tax deductions for parents, very parental. But the last one, and the most important one, is on free movement. Now, this one was called through a popular referendum. To note, in Switzerland, you need 50,000 votes to have a popular referendum on an issue that the government has voted against, and 100,000 votes to have a referendum on, in a sense, any issue. Now, this would be called by the right-wing party called, and I will have the name of it in one moment, the Swiss People's Party is the name of them, down to SVP. And essentially, this seeks to renegotiate free movement of peoples into Switzerland. As many listeners might be aware, Switzerland has many bilateral deals with the European Union, which means that ultimately its immigration policies aren't directed by Bern, the capital and where all the laws are made, but a lot are actually through negotiated deals with the EU, the most recent of which was signed in 2014. This angered many further right-wing groups who saw Bern in effect giving away all free membership, free movement and deals and border issues to the EU. And so this referendum calls on them to renegotiate the deal. They have 1 year to do so. However, even if it does pass, and to note, it's unlikely to, this will still likely fail, because after 3 months, I believe, if there is no movement of it between the EU and Switzerland, the negotiations stop. But it's still interesting to see that this has come back on the agenda. They have attempted to call referendums before on this matter, but this one went through. And if it does pass, it is worth noting as well that many other bilateral deals with the EU fail. They become legally incompatible with this new law. So some see this as kind of a more step-by-step approach to Euroscepticism within Switzerland, which is on the rise. Yet others also see this as simply a power grab by a party who hasn't particularly done well in the most recent elections. Any questions or throwing it open there to them?
Switzerland is in EFTA and in the European Economic Area.
Correct, yes.
Isn't freedom of movement an important aspect of these two organizations?
Why, that is very true, which is why it has been a very confusing way to go about it. Some people believe this is a way for the right-wing group to simply, yes, the Swiss People's Party, that was correct, to simply have a vague referendum on EFTA and EEA, whilst not, because they would actually probably get defeated on such a referendum. But it's also a way for them to kind of renegotiate the battlegrounds for this. EU membership, EFTA membership, EEA membership has been going back and forth in Swiss politics for decades, literal decades. They have had many referendums defeated on joining the EU, and every bilateral agreement is, or most of them anyway, do have to go to a referendum as well. And so the Swiss People's Party, in this sense, are trying to move immigration to the top of the political agenda. Although the political agenda in Switzerland is, of course, very full, because there are many referendums. I think there are at least a dozen a year. So this could also just be a passing fad. But it's probably one of the most interesting approaches the People's Party have taken recently. And that such a referendum title has not necessarily been tested by the courts is an interesting point. Although, of course, they're independent, they are there to mention any legal issues with potential referenda issues. Although the government is fighting this quite sincerely, and the government will likely win on this matter. Any others?
Well, I think that although it's, like you say, it is interesting, but it's also not unusual for Switzerland, because I think it's well known that Switzerland, although it might change at some point, but still has a very anti-migration atmosphere. Like, the country is not very open to migration. It has always been like that. So it would be interesting to see what will happen and how the European Union will react to this rise in Euroscepticism in Switzerland. I think it's also interesting in relation to Brexit, actually.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. There have been some claims, almost accusations, as you say, that the EU is being particularly hard on Switzerland recently, to push Brexit Britain away from the idea of becoming like Switzerland. Switzerland's in a very unique position, although quite similar to Norway, in having bilateral agreements, and Iceland for that matter, having bilateral agreements that prefer them. And so in one sense, maybe this is almost the counter response to the EU's hardening on Swiss matters, because the EU started to renegotiate some of their deals in 2017 and 2018, after some of the botched deals with the UK government. And so potentially this is also the Swiss People's Party saying, look, we're not a pawn in your game. We have issues. We have matters we want to talk about. This is one of them. Let's do it, really. It could also be, to be honest, a pushback against what many Swiss people see as just less qualified Europeans coming to Switzerland for much higher paying jobs. Of course, Switzerland being one of the most highest paying countries in the world, and having a very robust labour market, a very competitive labour market, many Swiss, or some Swiss at least, do feel like that Europeans are coming in with no real, with the Swiss government having no real control over it, and just taking jobs that are theirs. And in this case, when you truly do have a country that's not a member of the European Union, having the European Union making some of the decisions, not all of them, on who's entering, it must seem quite discerning from them. And I'm certain this is definitely in the mind of the Swiss People's Party when they made it. And if you see some of the first few adverts that they've put out, campaigning for it has already begun, you do definitely see that focus on the Swiss lives, you know. This immigration is hurting Swiss lives, it's hurting our job prospects. But as Eva just mentioned, they've always been known for being rather protectionist in their labour market especially. And so maybe this is another twist in the matter. But it is worth noting, if it does pass, then it cuts into a guillotine clause in the first round of bilateral agreements that the Switzerland and the EU signed, which could have profound impacts on everything from banking to childcare to the very relationship between the EU and Switzerland. So the fact that this has come under such question, under such, I guess, a banal situation, is highlighting the precariousness of the two's relationship and whether something's changed with that. Neither side are really up to it. Their deal and their relationship right now is beneficial to both without being too taxing to both. And of course, the Swiss do love their taxes. So they're in a bit of a balanced situation. But the Swiss People's Parties are definitely there to try and push it in their balance. We'll see how successful they are in a few weeks' time, much like for the Romanian elections. Any other comments or questions?
This whole topic of freedom of movement in Switzerland has reminded me of something I've written in my first article for the Institute, which was on Brexit.
Of course.
In this article, I was talking about sort of the Norwegian model of EA membership and rejoining EFTA. And I remember I wrote that there are actually two opt-outs in the European Economic Area Treaty with regards to immigration. There's Article 112, which says that immigration can be restricted in order to address societal or environmental difficulties of a sectoral or regional nature, which is what Liechtenstein has been doing since 1997. And then you have Article 28 stating that freedom of movement can be subject to limitations justified on grounds of public policy, public security, or public health. And I think this recent this ongoing coronavirus pandemic has legitimized the right-wing narratives about border closures. And sadly, it has, well, for better or worse, it has shown that you can close the borders for good reasons.
That's true. And no doubt about it, the Swiss People's Party going to highlight on that. And especially, I want to pick up one thing you said, which is the environmental reasons. Switzerland has been going through quite a green phase recently of all sides of the parties essentially doing it. And even the Swiss People's Party have been looking into a particular referendum in November on responsible companies protecting human beings and the environment, which is another referendum coming up. And it's interesting to see if those two are going to unite, essentially, whether they say, well, we need to reduce immigration for environmental reasons, which could be an interesting one indeed. I guess I have one final comment before we do leave, which is on the parental side. Switzerland is one of the only countries in Europe without any parental leave whatsoever. And this new referendum, from the government, essentially, they have parental leave that companies do themselves, but there is no implication for actual parental leave. And not only would introducing it be a very new twist in the Swiss government's relationship to its people. Switzerland has always had a very small government in aspects. The aspect of direct democracy only encourages this. But combined with the tax deductions for parents, this does move Switzerland to a bit more of a parental model, which could have more profound impacts, actually. And it has caused a bit of a cleavage within the aforementioned Swiss People's Parties, where local parties are supporting it, but the national party is not. Many of the more popular ones, the Liberals, have not even commented on such a referendum. So if there's actually a real battleground this September, it's not on the big ones, it's not on the fighter jets, it's not on the EU movement, not on hunting, but it's actually on the simple parents, really. So we'll definitely make a small report on what happens on all of these elections coming up. So that's quite an interesting one there. Anything else?
One who doesn't know Switzerland would be surprised to hear about this matter of not having parental leave. But let's remind our listeners that Switzerland gave women the vote in the 1970s and only became a UN member in 2002. So really, this shouldn't surprise us.
That's true, but they've taken aspects of individuality quite far. Like, although the women's election, for example, won for everything, it is quite surprising to see how Switzerland is profoundly ahead in many aspects. But in some sort of institutional, and I guess, yeah, in aspects where their relationship to the government is very different, they don't have them so far. But Switzerland is a country we'd love to focus more on, actually, the Institute, I'd say, because it's not one we looked at too much. Although do check out our partner who is talking about it, Politique Perspective. They have a few more articles about Switzerland, Germany and Austria, the German-speaking countries to look at. And Liechtenstein, of course. Never forget Liechtenstein. Okay. On that note, we will leave it here for episode 19 of the Great European Talks. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining. Thank you to Adrian from Rome, Eva from here in Bruges, along with myself, and Ruxandra from
Suchava. I'm helping Suchava. You.
I wrote this down, listeners. I apologize, Ruxandra, for not getting it sooner.
No worries.
But thank you, everyone. Next week, we will hopefully be talking about the Middle East and North Africa. And for that, I'll be inviting a few new speakers as well. So thank you very much for tuning in this week. We hope you all stay safe. We hope you all enjoyed.
Yeah, das te živi I zdravi. That's a Macedonian expression meaning may you be alive and well.
Thank you very much, Adrian. And have a wonderful rest of the week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.